Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So Thursday morning, we've had about 36 hours to process. And, you know, I know how people are reacting here in our very deep blue dot in Massachusetts. But, Matt, you've never voted for Trump. But I think when he went last time, you weren't necessarily in a deep depression. You're like, okay, let's see how this goes, right?
Yeah. Well, I know how this goes, Bill. This ends with you being marooned outside, literally kicked outside your house, forced to do podcasts, homeless, from an encampment somewhere in Massachusetts. So that's how this ends, you know, with a whimper.
I'm supporting my dog. Maybe my dog is a secret Trumper. He's trying to interfere in our free speech.
So basically, America is West Virginia. So for me, it's no different. This is my normal life. The entire country is now West Virginia. We welcome our new overlords. And just remember, I was always for you. And Bill was always the bad one. So anyway, yeah.
Do you know anyone in West Virginia who voted for Harris? Or are you like the only one?
No. I definitely know Harris supporters in my neighborhood, close by. But, I mean, you got to realize, I mean, even in a state like West Virginia, 4 out of 10 people voted for Harris. So
was it 4?
That's a drubbing, right?
That was more like 3 in 10 in West Virginia.
Whatever it may be, there's still people. But no, look, I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge an ass whooping. This was a thumping. Trump won. It looks like he's going to probably going to win all 7 swing states.
Yeah.
Probably going to win the popular vote. There's probably going to be unified government, meaning Republicans will also win the House. So really just a devastating loss, I think, for Democrats.
Although he's the first Republican to win the popular vote since Bush in 2004.
Big deal, right? I mean, it's really amazing, right? This is a guy who's campaign consisted of saying that Haitians were eating dogs and cats and talking about Arnold Palmer's penis. And yet he becomes the first Republican, as you noted, to win the popular vote in many years. So I don't know what to make of that, but welcome to the new normal, Bill. America is West Virginia.
Well, you have, you know, we're all in our different stages of grief, but you have a list. You're trying to sort it out through list making, correct?
Yes. Is that bargaining? I'm not sure where that is in the grief stages. I have a list of, so I came up with 7 reasons that Dems lost. I have some additional observations, and then I have some what ifs that I thought might be fun for us to go through. Do you want to start with the 7 reasons that I think things turned out this way?
Sure. You have 7, but I have 1. But go with your 7.
All right. I'm going to go in inverse order, David Letterman top 10 list style. So I'm going to start with some fairly petty reasons, and then I think we're going to end with some very fundamental, serious, and important reasons. But we'll start, you know, nitpicking here. And I think she waited too long for those media interviews, which killed her momentum. And then once she finally did those interviews, she wasn't great at them. So again, that's my number 7, not a deep fundamental reason she lost, but I do think it contributed. Who knows, had she been able to keep the momentum that she had out of the gate, maybe she does a little better. What do you make of that?
I don't fully buy that. I think she, you know, it was always going to be hard to go on pure vibes from July to November. So you're going to have to pivot to the more traditional, you know, her best run was when she wasn't doing interviews. You know, you could argue she should have done any. She's just like, just done rallies, snubbed it all, done friendly podcast, and you know, I leave it at that. But I just think you ride the wave for as long as you can, and then the name of the game is trying to keep making news in different ways. And I can certainly quibble about certain interviews here and there, but I think on the whole, she gave fine interviews. Closed very strong, and you know, Trump's interviews were generally ridiculous. So it's not like he properly subjected himself to the scrutiny of the mainstream media. He retreated mainly to conservative media silos and podcast world. The few times he did venture out, like with the Bloomberg TV interview, like he couldn't defend himself, or the New York Economic Club gave weird rambling answers. He was never really on point or defended himself, defended the details of his plans. So I think to harp on that is, I mean, people may have double standards, and maybe we live in a world of unfair double standards.
They definitely have double standards. There's no doubt about that.
I think towards the
Van Jones quote about she has to be flawless. I forget.
He gets to be lawless.
Lawless, right. So that nailed it. Okay, let's move on. You're right. That's petty. Number six. I don't know if this is a reason Democrats lost or a symptom that they knew they were losing. But for reasons that escape me, she abandoned her message of joy and freedom and returned to democracy fascism at the end. And it occurs to me that that just didn't work anymore. Maybe it worked in 2022. Maybe it worked in 2020. I don't know. But not only did the democracy, save liberal democracy message not work, obviously, I think it also came across as sort of an example of moral superiority, ironically, like almost a highfalutin thing to be concerned about. So, but why? I assume that when she abandoned the sort of joy freedom messaging and went to democracy fascism, that there was polling to show that she had to do that. And maybe that in and of itself is a bad sign.
You know, it's a fine line to walk. You know, you want to, the top of the ticket should be positive. You know, everyone below that should do all the dirty work. You know, so if I was to, you know, go back in time, I might leave that talk to Tim Walz and the other surrogates into the ads and keep her strictly on a positive tip. But, and at the risk of, you know, jumping to the end here, you know, she had a big headwind with people's perception of the economy, which Democrats also had in 2022. And in many races overcame that with a focus on democracy as well as abortion. You know, Biden gave a big speech in that regard late in the game, and that helped beat, you know, Carrie Lake in Arizona and Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania, Herschel Walker in Georgia. So it's not that we didn't have some evidence that there were people there saying, you know, really, I mean, the inflation was much worse in 2022.
No, you're getting. Let's hold that. But let me say that you've mentioned something that I think deserves additional comment, which is, if you were hoping to believe Kamala could win, then you could look to who's the Hopium guy who's been on our show?
Simon Rosenberg.
Good guy, Simon Rosenberg, who two or three election cycles in a row had been correct in predicting that Democrats would do better than polling suggested. And I think he had built up credibility, and he was a firm believer that the American public, regardless of what exit polls said or whatever, that the American public cared about the democracy message. And so I think Simon Rosenberg had developed a very good reputation of being right, despite polling, sort of suggesting that he wouldn't be. And then I think the Ann Selzer poll, which caused us to do an emergency episode where you slightly revised.
Is this a new reason, or are we still on the democracy?
We're not on reasons yet.
Okay.
But you've triggered this thought. My only point here is if you were looking to believe that Kamala could win, there were voices who had been credible in the past in these recent election cycles that would lead you to maybe trust them and hope that they were right once again.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put, not to be disrespectful to Simon Rosenberg, but you know, he was doing a thing where like he was going to give the Democratic positive argument all the time. So I wouldn't necessarily base my analysis on what he was offering. But I do.
Wait, so you think that was like either a shtick or a marketing? Like, I'm going to be the Hopium guy as opposed to.
I mean, it's literally the name of his newsletter, the Hopium Chronicles. I mean, is the product. So he professionally could never give you the counter argument. You went there for the one side argument.
Whether it was spin or sincere, he was very good at buttressing his opinions with data. But I will say, to your point, Bill, he was a long supporter of Joe Biden long after it was clear that Biden couldn't win. And so that, I think that's a strike against him.
I think it's sort of a common sense. I mean, at some point you go beyond data, go with your gut. It's not a crazy conclusion for a politician or campaign operative to make that, hey, people who worked for Trump say he's a fascist. That's a pretty powerful argument. Let's talk about that. That perhaps could be a nuclear weapon that could obliterate any other headwinds that are in our way. You got to play that card. Now, maybe when Harris was asked the question at the CNN town hall that she did, again, here's a pretty high profile interview that she did, which I think, you know, she didn't really have any missteps in late in the game. But when she was asked, do you think he's a fascist? She said, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, that was sort of like refreshingly straightforward, no hemming and hawing. But I might have said, I wasn't saying that. John Kelly said that. You know, I wasn't coming to the conclusion on my own. But now I'm hearing from the people who work the closest with him that he's a fascist. I have to take their word. I might have put it in that way. I do not think this is like why the election.
I think she followed up with. I think she followed up with that, but
she did. But I would have leaned much, because I do think there was a lot of Republican pushback. You say he's a fascist, because you'll say, well, Trump calls Kamala a fascist. Well, she says he's a fascist, and he says she's a fascist. All this name calling, people are sick of it. You know, it was much easier to both sides it when it's put that way. I think it's harder to both sides it if you were really strict and consistent, saying we weren't saying this. We weren't using this language, but now the people closest to him are. We have to take that seriously.
Look, on one hand, this is literally the first presidential election since the January 6th insurrection. So you might be led to believe, if you were like from outer space and you showed up, you might think, well, the first presidential election since the January 6th Capitol riot, there's going to be paybacks. On the other hand, it's time flies, and there's, you know, we have short attention spans these days, and there have been other elections, off-year elections, midterm elections. This has been litigated. I think Republicans have paid an electoral price in the past for that, and people move on, I think, sadly, but people move on. And I think it's been talked about so much that people are sick of it. And I do, to what I said earlier, I do believe that there is a sense of moral superiority where at some point, a lot of Americans, and certainly MAGA supporters, but a lot of Americans started to feel like they're calling us deplorable. And that's an amazing act of, what is it, prestidigitation? Is that how it's pronounced, that Donald Trump did? But anyway, it is what it is. Let's go to number five. Now I think we're starting to get into more substantive arguments, more substantive reasons Democrats lost. Five is her 2019 radicalism. There was this GOP ad, you probably saw it, about Harris's endorsement of taxpayer-funded gender transition surgery for migrant detainees and prisoners. I think that did hurt her. And look, I think she ran a pretty good campaign this time around, all things considered. I know that's a controversial statement. A lot of people think she ran a horrible campaign. I think she ran a pretty good campaign, but you just can't get past the 2019 stuff. I think some of her fate was sealed based on that, the things that she said when she was trying during this very woke era, trying to become the Democratic nominee in 2019.
I think it didn't help. Certainly if you could go back in time, you wouldn't, either take the same positions, or you might talk about it in a different way. You know, the transgender prison thing, you might have talked about it saying, you know, there are federal laws and guidelines about medical care for all prisoners, and we're going to follow those guidelines and just sort of not have the precise words leave your mouth the way they can be clipped and used in an ad. But you know, she's hardly the first candidate that ran to the ideological edge in a primary and sought to run to the center in a general. There's all sorts of zigzags that Donald Trump has done that make your head explode.
But the context, I agree with that totally. Trump has flip-flopped on everything, including abortion. But again, it's she has to be flawless, right?
And I do think that almost every candidate, Democrat candidate in 2020, made a big mistake, and I wrote about this at the time, that they thought that they could go pretty hard left, not that they needed to win the primary, and that it wouldn't cause a problem to the general. And you know, Biden, you know, cut against that thinking and won the primary. And I thought it was a misread of the Democratic electorate as well as the national electorate. So her campaign was definitely in 2020, you know, damaged by that thinking, but also damaged by other campaigns too. And I do think it was somewhat of a drag in this campaign, but I wouldn't say it was the primary reason.
Agree. I do think that part of the context here, the backdrop of this, is that a lot of average Americans, a lot of Americans, including Hispanic men, particularly African-American men, there's a backlash against wokeism and against, leftism, progressivism. And I think that so this was a bad political environment for those 2019 comments to reemerge.
Well, you certainly see some evidence of that with younger men. We did see in the exit poll data, in the overall gender gap data, Harris did a little worse with men compared to Joe Biden, and a little worse with women compared to Joe Biden. And so you were left with, she won women by 10 and lost men by 10 in the exit poll. And some people use different sources of data for 2020. I use Catalyst, which is better than exit poll. And some people use Pew, which is also better than exit poll, but I've been using Catalyst. And Catalyst, Biden won women by 11 and lost men by 6. So that gives you a 17-point gender gap. Just subtract the difference in the margins, but with a 5-point tilt towards Biden, 5-point better margin women versus men. With Harris and Trump, you have a 20-point gender gap, 10 plus 10, but zero tilt. So even though you get a few more women in the electorate than men, you want a bigger tilt to win nationally. And those numbers actually might be adjusted, considering that Trump's looking to win the popular vote overall. I bet that tent and even split's probably going to get tweaked. I think they tend to revise the data once the popular vote comes in, because it really suggests that either Trump did a little bit better with men than an even split, or Harris did a little bit worse with women. That's the overall. That's the overall. You see Harris do a little better than 2020 with senior women, and a little bit better than 2020 with college educated women. Whereas you're seeing, a big bleed with younger men. There's other, shifts under the hood there too. But I think that's a pretty big one. I do think that as a certain validation to this kind of, woke mind virus backlash. I don't think it's like it's everybody, but there definitely is a sort of this man-o-verse Joe Rogan world that younger boys seem to be in that seems to have some impact there.
Yeah. Well, let me just say, maybe this goes without saying, but, I feel like we're grappling with what happened and how to interpret it. And as political commentators, what am I going to do? I can't move to West Virginia. I live in West Virginia. I can't start going to an evangelical church. I go to an event. We are trying to figure out what in the hell's going on. And I just have to confess, I found Kamala Harris pretty likable, pretty charming. And even though I think there's a potential upside to part of Trump winning, I thought the downside greatly outweighed the upside, the character's destiny, and that the things he said, the vulgarity, the authoritarian stuff. I'm out of touch, very clearly, either with the American public or they just don't know. I don't know. But this next one, so let me just go through. Number 7, she waited too long for media interviews. Number 6, she abandoned the message of joy and freedom and returned to democracy fascism. Number 5, her 2019 radicalism cost her. We're on to number 4. This one is also controversial, Bill. Number 4 is sexism. So there are a lot of people right now who are pushing back, and it's not just MAGA folks. If you bring up the fact that Harris was hurt because she was a woman, that is seen as, hey, man, you just don't get it. You're not even going to grapple with the results. I'm like, no, I am grappling with it. I just talked about that. We are grappling. We're trying to figure out what the hell's going on and why we may be out of touch. I don't know, morally, aesthetically, whatever, with a lot of Americans, certainly the majority of the electorate in 2024. But we got to call them as we see them. And I think, Bill, I'll speak for myself. and you know this better than I do, though, Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress, the first African-American woman. She runs for president in 1972. This is her words, not mine, but she says, of my two handicaps, being a woman was the worst. I'm paraphrasing, but she uses the term handicaps. Mm-hmm. Being a woman was worse than being an African-American running for president in 1972, according to Shirley Chisholm. I believe that there were a certain percentage of, not everybody, but there were a lot of people. There were a lot of people who just weren't going to vote for a woman. They might not even realize that consciously. And I suspect that some of them are actually women. Some of the people who won't vote for a woman are women. Some of them are white men. Some of them are black men. Some of them are Hispanic men. Mm-hmm. Some of them are women again. But there is a fear that a woman cannot stand up against Putin or whatever. I think a lot of this, again, is subconscious, but I do believe that it exists and that it hurt Harris. I don't know how we could quantify this. The best evidence I have is anecdotal, which came from a Sarah Longwell focus group that I listened to maybe 6 months ago, where she was interviewing voters, including women, who were saying, this is way before Kamala Harris was the nominee, who were saying that they couldn't vote for a woman for president. Clearly, they're okay with a senator. They're okay with a governor. But president is different. They'll vote for a woman senator. They won't vote for a woman for president. I know this opens me up to attacks. Hey, man, you don't get it. You're not going to. No, this is one of seven reasons. I'm not saying it's the only reason. It's one of seven. Bill, what do you think?
I think we have a decent amount of objective data we can look at here.
We're 0 for 2.
What's that?
We're 0 for 2.
Right. And in both those cases, look, I mean, you look at the gender gaps over the last 50 years, you know, they got wider after 1980. But the biggest ones are almost all in the Donald Trump era. And it gets still pretty wide with Biden. He won women by
11. Theoretically, a gender gap could help Harris or a female candidate.
Potentially, yeah.
But it seems to me that was the case with Biden.
And I misspoke before. He won women by 13, not 11 in Catalyst. So you had a 19-point gender gap, but with a 7-point tilt to Biden. With Harris, you have a 20-point gender gap, but doing 4 points worse with men and losing 3 points with women. And with Hillary, it was her winning women by 13 and losing men by 11. So you're having double digit losses with men with the two female candidates that Biden was able to do better with. And Harris doing a little bit worse than both of them when it comes to women. Now, the only other times you have times when Democrats did double digit losses with men, and that was Gore and Kerry, but they were sort of weaker overall. Gore is sort of is kind of similar. Gore wasn't even split, but that's a pretty wide gender gap that year. It's the only other gender gap that's more 20 or more outside of the Trump era is Gore Bush. And there was definitely a lot of kind of, you know, macho Texan Bush, you know, Gore and a feet liberal stuff going on there. So there's that data. We have anecdotal data where we've heard people literally say, either firsthand or secondhand to reporters, women are too emotional. I'm not sure women can be a commander in chief. You know, we've heard that stuff. We have, I think, just the media treatment. I mean, back to the Van Jones thing. The media standards put on her were not the same as the standards put on Trump. The fact that the simplest, stuff that all politicians do, you know, don't answer a question perfectly directly, you know, you dance around an uncomfortable question, not give complete detail. This is the kind of stuff where she gave the complete detail. Mm-hmm. She might get treated by like a Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren saying, oh, all your plans, all this dirty wonk stuff. Why can't you speak like a regular person? She actually does a much better job speaking like a regular person. And then she gets hit for not having enough detail. So it's that kind of, it's never good enough, which clearly that standard doesn't get applied to Trump whenever he does anything.
This brings me to number three. At a time when there's great resentment toward elites, Harris comes across as a politician. Bill, I think this helps explain why you and I liked Harris, not just philosophically, but that we liked her style aesthetically. We like politicians. Now, I think there are politicians that are cringy, that are too scripted and all that. And Harris used to be that person. I actually think she got a lot better. And I actually came to find her charming in this election, much to my surprise. But nevertheless, compared to Trump, who says crazy stuff, she came across as a politician. And I think just like Democrats should not nominate a woman anytime soon, I think maybe the next, maybe the first woman will be a Republican, right? First woman president might have to be a Republican. Like, I think Democrats probably cannot and will not nominate a woman. Maybe they should nominate someone who's not a politician. Because I do think we, certainly now, and presumably in 4 years, will be the same, but you never know. But we're in this different culture where politicians are out. And I don't just mean the overly scripted, you know, pointy head elite, but just any politician, anyone who's a politician, I don't think can compete against someone who talks regular, like a normal person. And so maybe it's Idiocracy all the way down. But what do you make of that?
Well, I think Harris talked like a regular person. I did not think she got bogged down in Washington speak at any point in the race. In fact, the knock on her was that she was avoiding, you know, policy detail. Of course, if she did that, then you would knock her for too much policy speak. This is all very Rorschach testy, but if you were talking to me, who do I want to have, you know, have a beer with, you know, Harris over Trump, you know, any day of the week.
Wait, that's you, Bill. That's you. Yeah. I don't think that's the majority
of America. Everybody, but I mean,
no, I don't think it's most people. I'd go for Harris, mm-hmm. but we'd be drinking wine.
You know, her favorability numbers. So I'm looking at the exit poll here. Okay. So they have, let me get the right one here.
All right. While you look that up, let me say this. Yeah. David Frum had a great explanation that I want to share. He said this to my friend Jamie Weinstein on the Dispatch podcast. And he's like, why do people think Trump comes across as a regular guy? And according to Frum, and this reminds me of Dave Chappelle's line about Trump being an honest liar. But according to Frum, when you ask Trump like a question, like a normal politician, if they're asked a tough question, they don't want to lie. So what they do is they sort of hem and haw and parry the question. Well, but the real issue, what the American voters care about is, and Trump doesn't do that because Trump is okay with lying. So because normal politicians don't want to lie, they look like they're concealing things and they're spinning. Trump is more than willing to lie. Therefore, he comes across as ironically honest. That's what Trump says. I think it's true.
Obviously, the people who buy into Trump certainly see it that way. But this is the thing that, you know, this gets back to, you know, why do you and your ivory tower don't see what real Americans think? I mean, I think if you look at Trump and say, you are a transparent fraud, you are a classic con artist, you have been literally convicted of fraud, we've had reams of investigations about all of your fraudulent practices, you are hawking chintzy products like, you know, branded Bibles made in China the way any low-class QVC fraudster would do. I saw you be president and lie to my face repeatedly. So like, if you see that, you have a hard time understanding how people don't see that.
Yeah.
That's
about the American people. And this is where we get into trouble. Because people are going to say, Matt, by the way, I don't care if Democrats win or not, but people say, Matt, if you want Democrats to win, you can't blame the American public. Okay. I do think that there was a version of the American public that if someone said, have you no decency, the American public took their role as citizens seriously and would reject a charlatan. I don't think we're there anymore. Look, here, let me make a conservative argument, Bill.
Yeah.
A conservative argument against Trumpism. Since the 1960s, we have degraded our culture. We have become a coarse culture. We've become a vulgar culture. Politics is downstream from culture. Donald Trump may be a delayed reaction, but he is in the inevitable outcome of an unserious, immoral American public. I truly do believe that. Now, we may have to figure out, maybe we run Oprah or The Rock. I don't know. Well, but that's where we are. Okay. Well, And so
I don't want to go down too many rabbit holes here. I'm sort of happy to talk about which we have a non-politician separately, but I want to just make a couple of points here. Okay. I mean, the Trump universe looks down on a wide swaths of Americans. The enemy within, the whole woke mind virus thing is that people who care about diversity and inclusion are bad people. Childless cat ladies are bad people. You don't have kids. You don't have a future in the state of the country. You're a bad person. We shouldn't trust you with power. There's all sorts of hatred that put upon nearly half the country. And that's okay. I mean, this is where, I almost need to use the word gaslighting, which, you know, Harris did. That's one of the few words I feel like, I bet a lot of Americans don't use that word. That word's used more in a blue America context. Maybe not the best choice. But that is what's going on here. You know, anything that is said about Trump as an individual is then cast as you hate all of his people. And if I say, I think he's a fraud, and I'm frustrated that people don't see that he's also a fraud, you hate Americans? We're like, you know, you're telling, you spew hatred at the rest of us all day long, and that's always okay. Trump literally practices, you know, what used to be called wedge politics all the time.
Yeah.
Us versus them politics. That is the lifeblood of the movement.
He wants us to be the majority, or at least the Electoral College majority, in this case, the majority. Was it Rich Lowry? Somebody said that Donald Trump is a giant middle finger. And I think that is so true. I was thinking, Bill, and this does not account for, there are a lot of people who voted for Trump, obviously, a majority of Americans, and they represent many different motives and reasons. But I was thinking, for me personally, what is the scenario where I would be a Trump voter? And I think it would be because my life could have gone very differently. I graduate college. I'm working at a fast food restaurant. And I ended up volunteering on a political campaign, and that kind of set the course of my life. But like, it was pretty touch and go there. My dad was a prison guard for 30 years. The best job I could get was working at a fast food restaurant after college. And there was a scenario where I end up at a trailer park or just living with my mom in Pennsylvania. And I think I'd be pissed off. And I think I'd look at people like Kamala Harris as like the fortunate, the people, they're the elites.
I might look at Donald Trump and say, you're a billionaire trying to exploit me for your political gain.
It doesn't, for whatever reason, he's the middle finger. He's you. I have to be honest, and I don't understand the psychology of this. What you just explained, Bill, is perfectly logical, perfectly rational. But for some reason, if I'm being honest, if that had happened to me, I imagine he would be my retribution. Look, would it do me any good? No. I would be a victim, and I would be embracing my victimhood, but he would be my retribution. And I'm not saying that's why every Trump voter voted for him, because it's certainly not clear, but that is the scenario where I would have been a Trump voter.
So I just want to go back to where we initially started with this part, which is just likability. So in the exit poll, they asked you, do you have a favorable opinion of Harris and Trump? So only Harris favorable, 44. Only Trump favorable, 43. Both Harris and Trump, 2, neither 8. So on favorability, they're both basically the same, actually a slight edge towards Harris. So there's plenty of people out there that find her, this is not the Hillary issue. You know, Hillary had worse favorables.
Yeah. Another reason why I thought she might win.
Right.
Hillary almost won. Kamala was better than Hillary.
Which is why I think you have a better argument about the sexism here. It's like, well, I like her. You know, she seems like a perfectly nice person. She doesn't get me as angry as other politicians I've seen. You know, she comes across like a regular human being in a lot of interviews. But, you know, there's a little bit of politician-y thing there. And, you know, I still don't know about a woman as president. But, again, I don't think any of this is like – I mean, I would probably put sexism as number 2 on my list, but not number 1.
Okay. So we've gone through 5 reasons why I think Democrats did not win. We've got 2 more. I think these 2 are the most important. And number 2 is Biden and Biden's record. Joe Biden should not have run. Just 37% of Americans approved of his job as president. Meanwhile, Harris failed to separate herself from his presidency. She was tagged as the incumbent. She was She became the incumbent, not the, quote, change candidate. As you know, independents and undecideds tend to break against the incumbent. And look, Bill, I wrote a lot in 2021 about inflation, crime, the border, Afghanistan. I really feel like a lot of the 2024 election results, the problems began in 2021. The Joe Biden's out of the gate, thinks he's going to be LBJ, thinks he's going to be FDR, signs this huge spending bill, which I don't think caused inflation, but it certainly contributed to it. He signs these executive orders on the border. Harris, then, and here's, I think Harris is actually a nice person. I really do. I've heard stories where she's mean to her staff, but I think she's deep down a fundamentally good, nice, loyal person. And so she couldn't throw Biden under the bus, but I think she had to. In hindsight, you know, when she goes on The View and they ask her, how are you going to be different? And she does not have an answer. I think she, a more cutthroat, ambitious politician throws him under the bus. What do you make of it?
I mean, she was cutthroat enough to throw him under the bus in the 2020 debates. So it's not like she doesn't have that side. It's just a hard place to be when you're vice president. Look, the View answer should have gone better, as I think we talked about. I mean, I literally believe I changed that answer when I posted on Twitter.
No, I think
immediately
you did.
That she had an available answer about a Republican in the cabinet. She said so on the show 20 minutes later. And
Bill, I think you changed her answer, and I still don't think it was a great answer.
Well, if she said it right away, it would be different. If that was the answer out of the box,
your answer was, "I'll be different than Biden because I'll put a Republican in my cabinet."
If she said that, I mean, you could have built on that. She could have said, "I think we, started the administration on the wrong foot. It took us too long to get the infrastructure bill done. If we had a Republican on our team and had more opinions and feedback in making our policies from the get-go, I think we would have a smoother begin to our administration." And that's the way I want to start. In my opinion.
I think she had to be tougher. I think she had to go after Biden. And I think she had to be this, if she was going to win, in hindsight, I think she had to give up the whole, I was the vice president, I own this part of this agenda. And she had to really go after Biden
in full hindsight, you might roll the dice on that, but there's obviously downside risk to that too. You potentially cause a lot of base dissension, have a lot of news cycles about intra-party bloodletting, which I mean, she was able to keep that party unified all the way through. It was pretty leak-free. She didn't have, much base bleed. You look in the exit poll data, she was softer with moderates than with liberals. You can also look through a little bit, on the Gaza stuff, with Dearborn, Michigan, but that was not the margin of victory in Michigan. So I think on the whole, she maintained that. So to your point, she was soft with the moderates. She won moderates, but not by as much as Biden did. And you could argue, well, that called for a bigger break with Biden, but there was a risk that you would cause a problem with the base if you did that, and might have been zero sum. So I don't think it's a simple call. I would say that one answer could have been better. And she could have been just a little bit more precise with future answers to that question. We didn't do enough on housing. That's why I want to do this big housing program. We didn't do enough on constraining prices. That's why I want to have this price gouging bill. She could have been a little more pointed about it, but I still think the bigger headwind probably gets to, number one,
right,
is the inflation itself.
Right. So number one is related to number two. And I think you tell me, Bill, but I think number one is 80% of the ballgame, right? It's not 100%. I got seven reasons, but I think 80% of it is number one, inflation. It turns out other economic indicators, including a 4.1% unemployment rate, Bill, doesn't matter at all. Inflation is death. And I was reminded today when I went back and looked up the warnings that I made about inflation, that Joe Biden didn't even acknowledge that there was inflation or that it was a problem. And I think that is also part of the problem. But fundamentally, inflation is devastating. You can say the economy is great in many ways. It's a good economy. A lot of economic indicators are positive. It doesn't matter. Bill, do you know what a cup of coffee cost me in West Virginia? A cup of coffee. We're over $4.
From where?
At a good coffee. Amy and Alex's, or Joe and Jones, or Gazelle's in downtown Charlestown, whatever. We're talking West Virginia, $4 for a cup of, it's gourmet coffee, but it's still just regular coffee though. I mean, just like black, a cup of black coffee, medium. You're over $4 in West Virginia, Bill.
I'm sure we'll fix that problem. Is a good tariff on imported coffee beans. That will definitely
bring that
price down. But look, I think this is mainly about inflation. I don't know if I put a percentage on it, but I would just say if we didn't have a perception of an inflation problem, this is a whole different race. Like that this is why you have. I mean, the popular vote number may shift still as the California votes come in, but as of last night, you're talking a 7.8 margin shift from 2020 to 2024. Then it's pretty much across the board nationwide. There's state variations, but there's generally almost every state got redder than before. And that to me is widespread frustration with the economy. And look, I was making the opposite argument all year. So I'm not trying to, pat myself on the back in any stretch. We don't have another example in the last 100 years when GDP is strong, unemployment is low, real disposable income. So real disposable income is the money you have in your pocket after taxes, accounting for inflation. That number is up 9% over the past 2+ years. And that's a faster rate of growth. I mean, so for Trump, before the pandemic, 3-year period, it was about 8.5%. Obama for his 4-year period, about 8.5%. So 9% over a two year in a couple months, it's pretty darn good. And so, I was looking at the example of 1984, where you had a bona fide recession in the first part of Reagan's term. You had high inflation that covered that period, carryover from Carter and Ford Nixon. And by 1984, the GDP comes back, unemployment has come down some, but still kind of high. Mortgage rates, inflation came way down, but mortgage rates were double digits in 1984. But you have a Morning in America ad campaign that's literally saying it's easier to buy a house now, that people can get married with the comfort knowing they can afford to buy a house. Mm-hmm. So you're taking a trajectory in your favor, but really putting some extra mustard on that goes kind of beyond what the numbers actually say, but people feel better. Now, the one difference there than now is that they came out of a recession. So the economic growth maybe even feels like more of a jolt of positivity than you had back then. But we came out of a pandemic, this goes to your number two argument. I think if you had a, replacement level president, normal president, of I don't want to be ageist about it, but it's not just about the number, but just someone who had, maintained basic cognitive abilities and communication skills.
Yeah. Biden couldn't sell his successes.
Yeah.
So they became failures.
But to put an extra sort of substantive point on this, this goes beyond the communication skills, the decision to initially wave off inflation was a terrible decision. Yeah.
His instinct on everything, Bill. He did that to every single problem, whether it's the border or crime or inflation or Afghanistan. Every time their instinct was, there's no problem.
Well, look, Donald Trump does that all the time. So,
okay. The rules do not apply to
other politicians. Do what you think. There are times when that is the right play. But inflation is not one of them. If you wave it off publicly and then you fix it in a month, then fine. But the problem is inflation can be a very difficult thing to fix and can take some time. And from a technical standpoint, maybe it was transitory, but still transitory still takes some time to transition. And when the transition period is over, the prices are still elevated from where they are before. So to be that dismissive about it is very, very dangerous. And on top of all of that, you have an American Rescue Plan Act that preceded the inflation spike, which was done in a partisan way and was a massive amount of spending. Now, there is an argument that it's not ARPA's fault. We had inflation worldwide because of supply pandemic-related supply chain problems. There is a counter argument that, you know, ARPA maybe like jacked up a little bit up front, but it was still good for the economy overall, and that spending ended and inflation came down afterwards. So in the big picture, it was all okay, but it was a little tough up front. Regardless of the economic debate about it, if I was running the show, and I said so at the time, you could have done a bipartisan pandemic relief bill. There was an offer made by Susan Collins. I'm not just being hypothetical. She put an offer on the table. Democrats just thought it was stingy because they had bought into a narrative that Obama went too small with his Recovery Act, which I think is also a warped perspective, although I do understand the desire for a bigger stimulus and the long recovery.
The problem for Democrats is Republicans had just passed a huge COVID relief bill a month earlier.
Well, that's right. They did. But if you want to do a little bit more, I mean, everything that Trump passed on the pandemic was bipartisan. He ended up taking excess credit for the checks. And then I heard Kamala on the Club Shay Shay podcast just last week having to say, you know, Trump didn't personally send you those checks. That was there's a Democratic-led Congress that passed those bills.
People think because Trump put his name on the checks, right? Yeah.
Right.
And Biden wouldn't do that. And right. People think Trump sent them money. They really do.
I've heard that anecdotally in the press accounts. Clearly, Harris is getting that in the data because she felt compelled to correct the point. Obviously, too little, too late. That aside, if you had an ARPA bill that was smaller, but was bipartisan, and the inflation still happened anyway because it was happening worldwide, it would at least be harder Republicans say, this is all your fault, Joe Biden. Can you say, hey, we're doing this together. We were doing pandemic relief together last year and this year. And they can layer on top of that. Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and the Republicans generally were blaming Jimmy Carter for the bad economy for a decade. You never forgot that the last bad economy was Jimmy Carter's fault. Even though that was a recession on Ronald Reagan's watch, everything is Jimmy Carter's fault. You never forgot it. And that Biden and the Democrats did not do that with Donald Trump in 2021. They just wanted him out. Maybe they thought he was not going to come back, or they just thought it was obvious, or they just had their hands were full. They didn't, when that inflation first kicked up, instead of waving it up, be like, this Trump inflation is killing us. You know, Trump mishandled the pandemic and the place has been throttled and the supply chains are a problem. I just got here a few months ago. This is all Trump's fault. And by God darn it, we're going to take care of this inflation. That would have been a better way to handle it. And then you could say, once it improved, I had a plan for inflation and that's why it got better. I solved this mess that Donald Trump gave me. And so if we were in that place, I mean, so since we were not in that place and there is this perception, even though inflation has gone way down in the past 2 years, prices are, there's still hangover from that. There's still elevated prices. And Kamala walked into a situation where the perception was this was Biden's fault. She can't play that. She can't play the Trump's fault card. It's already baked into people's perceptions. And so she stuck saying, I know prices are high. Here's my price gouging plan, which is the best you can do at that moment, but it's obviously far from ideal. And I think it's where we are today.
Indeed. And I think we thought that inflation would hurt them, but it might be offset by the fact that the other economic indicators are good. And then there would be the abortion issue, which would drive people to the polls. It turns out, Bill, and I know we're up against it, so I don't want to drag on too long, but just some quick observations before we go. I think that in general, the abortion issue is great at driving people to the polls to vote on ballot issues about abortion. It doesn't tend to matter as it pertains to individual politicians. I also think we were wrong about the get out the vote. We thought that the fact that Harris had a organized get out the vote effort would help her.
This is my big issue. Can I jump in on this?
Well, let me just finish by saying,
okay.
I don't think it's dispositive, but I think what we learned is at the presidential level, we should never bring it up again because it doesn't seem to really matter. But go ahead.
Well, I always said, because I've wrote about this all year, and I always said, academic research shows that GUTV is at best a point. It's not going to be the thing that determines it if you have, you know, a bigger ship one way or the other. But we had
the wind
races,
is blowing in a direction.
Yeah,
it's not going to change.
Not going to save. But we had cases where in 2020 and 2016 where races were determined by less than a percentage point. And so it'd be very foolish to do a sloppy job with your GUTV. Now, if you look at, I mean, again, the numbers aren't finalized because there's still some boats trickling in, you know, particularly in California. But if you look at the margin shifts, state by state, again, right now we're looking at a 7.8 shift nationally. The shifts in the swing states were mostly much smaller. Now, again, at best, I'm going to give you a point on GUTV. So I'm not going to. So the fact that, that Pennsylvania, well, the smallest one was Wisconsin. They had a 1.5 margin shift. North Carolina's like 2.1. Georgia's 2.4. Pennsylvania's a 3.1. You know, so that's not all GOTV. You know, just the mere fact there's just more campaign there, more advertising there. That's got stuff to do with it also. But that does at least give me, I think, some evidence that they did have a good GOTV. Harris team did have a better GOTV campaign. This is not a case of the battleground states being skewed towards the Republican. This is not Electoral College skewed towards the Republican. This is Democrats punching above their weight. Every swing state seems to have Nevada is kind of close to the swing margin. But it seems like Democrats did a better job in the swing where things were most competitive. That's not to me an argument to go amateurish on your GTV because you might get almost all of this stuff has nothing to do with the campaign. If inflation is the thing, and Biden's missteps earlier on are what made this a Democratic problem. Interviews, rallies, endorsements, none of that matters. Even sexism, sexism obviously is a burden to bear, but I think harder to play that card if the economy is running on all cylinders and everyone agrees.
Now, I don't know what the percentages are, but certainly the candidate and the environment, sort of exogenous events, are dramatically more important than a well-run campaign, clearly.
How did Barack Obama crush John McCain in a relative landslide? The economy was in the tank.
Yeah.
So that made it a whole lot easier to do.
I come from a world where I want to believe that competence and that I want to believe that we can affect change. So I think I probably as an analyst, I probably overrate campaigns. And I need to quit doing that because clearly,
I mean, I would still argue that in the final week, we had the one Joe Biden garbage thing a little bit in the way, but I think the Madison Square Garden rally was the most dominant thing all week. Your point about Harris losing the joy, I think it was pretty pure joy in the final week. You know, she veered back to that, tried to end on an up note while there was a lot of media coverage about people being upset about what was said at the Madison Square Garden rally. And that did not matter at all. Even in the exit polling, you're seeing late deciders go to Trump. I don't think it means that people liked the Madison Square Garden rally or liked that Donald Trump, weirdly was a DJ at one of his rallies. I just think it means that when it came down to it, I'm frustrated with the economy and I want to change.
I think that's right. Well, look, we have a lot to talk about down the road. What if we could do the whole like what ifs? We could think what should we expect from a Trump administration? What do Democrats do now? How do they respond? But we're gonna have to save those for another day. I think we're up against it, Bill. But anything you want to plug or any final thoughts before we get you out of here? I think you need to leave your homeless decampment. You may have to seek shelter. It looks like it. Speaking of the wind. There is some wind in the background there, I think.
Well, you're welcome to come to the People's Republic of Massachusetts if you want to, maintain your rights. Their safe spaces still exist so far. I still got a comment.
What's your extradition process there? That's my concern, Bill.
I got a comment at the Washington Monthly talking about inflation as the main culprit here, but how the Democrats will still win again, and they'll win once the economy tanks, which I think could happen very, very shortly, especially if these tariffs, you know, are implemented the way Donald Trump says he intends to. And I'll probably have some more to say about Biden's role here in the Washington Monthly newsletter, which will come out later today.
Excellent. All right. Always a pleasure, my friend. I will see you down the road. And to the DMZ Army, thank you. Bill and I have been doing this for, I don't know, 12, 15 years, something like that. Thank you for supporting us all this time. And thank you for enduring Bill's repeated misses and mistakes that he's made along the way. And we'll see you very soon in the DMZ. See you, Bill.
Take care.